United States has officially declared Russian moves on Ukraine an invasion.
The terror caused by these attacks cannot be overstated. Their life's work and all their possessions blown away in an instant.
Ukrainian troops are proving to be a tough underdog, clawing back territory from Russia around Kyiv.
Every day, Ukrainians are taking to the streets to fight for their homeland.
Welcome, everybody, to this podcast live audience event, World Politics After Putin's War, Your Questions Answered. And I'm Zoe Williams, and tonight I'm joined by Luke Cooper, and both his academic and another Europe podcast hat on, as well as two terrific guests. Mary Kaldor has been studying war and conflict for decades, from the wars in the former Yugoslavia to contemporary conflicts in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. We'll be asking her what she makes of this unfolding tragedy in Ukraine. We're also very pleased to be talking to Denis Pilash, who is joining the discussion from Ukraine. Denis is a political scientist and a member of the Ukrainian left media platform Commons. We've received some great questions in advance, and we'll be throwing in some of our own too. Denis, let's go to you straight at the start. Can you give us an update on where things stand just over a month into Putin's invasion of Ukraine?
Yes, thank you for inviting me. Unfortunately, we are really into this month of the war in Ukraine. And this unilateral aggression by Russian imperialism has already claimed thousands of lives, of civilian lives, and the lives of tens of millions of people have been shattered as well. So they are broken. Many people were forced to flee. It's several millions who crossed the border to Poland, Hungary, Slovak Republic, Moldova, Romania, and so on. And many millions more who are now internally displaced persons who relocated to safer places in Ukraine to avoid these shellings and bombardments by the Russian military. But actually, many still stay in the cities that are constantly attacked. So we had heavy attacks on some of the major cities. A number of towns and villages were almost completely destroyed in ongoing clashes, like Izum or Volnovakha, or many of the Kyiv suburbs of Vorzel, Hostomel, Bucha, Irpin. So there the damage is really enormous. And actually, it also, we have this situation that can be compared probably with the worst nightmares of the previous humiliating conflict that swept through Ukraine and Europe in general. That was the Second World War. And some reports say really they lead us to compare what was done by Putin's forces to the atrocities of the Nazis. And, for instance, the plight of the siege city of Mariupol has been compared to the siege of blockade of Leningrad and other cities. And we have an unfolding humanitarian disaster in such places. So we have such a huge number of civilian and military casualties. Also, we can state that the initial plan by the Russian authorities, it was some kind of swift blitzkrieg on many dimensions and many directions in the north, in the east, and in the south. It failed because actually besides Kherson, there were no major cities captured by the Russian military. And it was some kind of, it wasn't so expected by many in the West who considered Ukraine to fall in a couple of days. But actually, it was revealed that the Russian forces miscalculated because they met this enormous resistance from both the armed forces of Ukraine and from the civilian population alike. So in many occupied cities like Kherson, Melitopol, Berdansk, smaller ones, villages and towns like Yukivka and so on, you could see these videos of huge crowds of Ukrainian civilians, men and women, Russian and Ukrainian speaking, mostly common working class people who are protesting the Russian occupiers, who are trying to stop their armored vehicles with their bare arms, and who are openly defying these armed soldiers who captured their cities and towns. And actually, it's the Russians more than a couple of weeks to even find some peacelings to collaborate with them. So it's almost a complete rejection of this invasion by the Ukrainian society. And it also means that besides those on the front lines, and besides it's more than hundreds of thousands of people who enlisted voluntarily, for instance, to these territorial defense units, you have millions of people, essential workers and humanitarian network volunteers who now are doing enormous job to keep the things going and to help the refugees. Obviously, the healthcare workers are doing a heck of a job, and many of them are also targeted and many have been killed. Transportation workers, for instance, the employees of the railroad, state railroad companies, they evacuated hundreds of thousands of people to safer places. And again, we have more than 50 railroad workers already killed. And this applies to many other spheres as well. So it's some kind of unexpected for many abroad people's wars that united people throughout the country to stop the offensive and to attack those ones who are now in the vulnerable positions. So now we are in some kind of stalemate when we got these results of some kind of preliminary talks in Istanbul between the delegations of Ukraine and Russia, but the future is really not clear.
Generally, how seriously do you take Putin's efforts for peace talks? I mean, do you think it's just a move? Do you think it's had any kind of lessening effect on the scale of the attacks?
I wouldn't say that it was some kind of initiative on the side of the Russian sort for all the previous years, when at least Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, was seeking direct negotiations with Putin, and he was constantly ignored as some kind of representative of power that isn't equal to Russia. So actually, that's a part of a more general vision of the Russian elites who see like them, the US, China, and maybe some countries like India and Brazil, the only ones that are really be taken seriously and that have some kind of sovereignty and agency. And he was constantly repeating that we are going to negotiate with Washington, not with Kyiv. Kyiv has no agency. Again, since this invasion started, like Ukrainian side was calling for a ceasefire, was calling to get at least to get these humanitarian corridors to evacuate people faces with these humanitarian catastrophes like Mariupol. But as the situation was unfolding in a way that wasn't expected by the Russian military and the Russian leadership, they had no clear vision what to do. One wants to be optimist, but still there are many reservations that they can be just some pretext to, for instance, like abandon those directions that are now deemed as not so successful for the Russian military, like they failed to get into Kyiv and Chernihiv, and to relocate these forces, for instance, for a more massive invading force in the Donbas, and probably to try to cut some Ukrainian armies and get them encircled, and so on. So we still have no clear guarantees, and we also have no clear signs of what we heard about these visions that were proposed. They were mostly proposals by the Ukrainian side that are restoring more or less the status quo before the invasion, before the 24th of February. And it's still not clear whether the Russian side, again, their delegation is not so, how to say, doesn't include like some officials. It has like the major figures there is Medinsky, who used to be a minister of culture. And the top decision makers are still somewhere in the Kremlin or more rightly in a bunker. So we still need to get a feedback whether these provisions will be trusted and will be in general part of a broader solution or not.
Mary, what is the purpose of the talks if it's not in good faith? And do you think it's not in good faith?
Do you know, I don't think any of us know. What is clear is that the Russians are doing much less well than they expected. As Dennis said, they thought they would have a short, victorious war and they'd be war. Apparently, their soldiers even bought their dress uniforms for their parade in Kyiv after 3 days. So they thought they would win. And what this war really shows us is that all military technologies are so powerful that it's very, very difficult nowadays to win. It's very easy to be extremely destructive, but it's very difficult to do what military strategists call compellence, making the other side do what you want to do.
Right.
And we have got a sort of stalemate, if you like. So the Russians say they're withdrawing from Kyiv and Chernihiv, and they seem to be moving, as Denis said, to the Donbass. So what does that mean about the talks? Well, you can see that the Russians have two options, really. They could escalate, and there is all this terrifying talk of chemical weapons and nuclear weapons and biological weapons going on, which is really frightening and is perhaps intended to frighten NATO and to make sure that NATO doesn't intervene. Or they can try and find a face-saving formula in the talks. Denis said they started increasing shelling. That's exactly what they did in Syria. I mean, in Syria, they negotiated some 300 local agreements. And when the other side didn't agree, they just shelled. If you ask me, there's total chaos in the Kremlin.
Right,
and nobody actually knows what they think, which is also why the other side of the discussion of the Ukraine war, it's incredibly important for us all to think about Russian opposition.
To go to a live audience question in the moment, Luke, we talk a lot about Russian strategy and where it succeeds and where it fails. Have you seen any public discussion of Ukrainian military strategy and where, how that might unfold?
There's less coverage of the Ukrainian strategy because, in at least in the Western world, because the media infrastructure of the West is very disciplined and the Ukrainian government supported. And I thought it was really interesting earlier what Denis was saying about the social infrastructure, that the civic support on the ground of volunteers in cities that are carrying out solidarity efforts are part of this civic picture of Ukrainian opposition. So it's not just a conventional war that the Ukrainian government is fighting, though of course it is that too, but the Russians have, or Putin has, the problem that he's facing a population, both in the West and in the East, that is rejecting the Russian invasion. And in the cities like Kherson, you've seen those courageous, that Russia has occupied, the few that they, cities and towns that they have occupied, you've seen courageous acts of nonviolent resistance too. So I think the whole picture in Ukraine is one of discipline around the use of information. And of course, this makes sense. It's a spontaneous reaction. Mm-hmm. If there's an invading army and you don't support them, you're much more likely to take pictures of their tanks being blown up by successful resistance than you are your own side's resistance. So that's perfectly logical in some ways. It's what we would expect. But I think it does explain how we don't get the full picture. And of course, that does mean that we should be cautious of how far we take the argument that Russia and Putin are failing here. Unfortunately, it's still early days. As Mary said, they do have a lot of power that they can inflict on Ukraine that they haven't put to their full capacity, even though they've had huge casualties and so on, far greater than they expected. And of course, from history, there are negative examples. Some of the bloodiest battles in history, I'm thinking of the Battle of Shanghai in 1937, has some parallels to what we see in Ukraine now, for the simple reason that the Japanese army was shocked and by the scale of the Chinese resistance. They thought China was a bit like Putin thinks of Ukraine, actually, kind of a fake country, a failing country, right? And that they would just roll over. That didn't happen in Shanghai. It was a very brutal battle of 3 months and, of course, a prolonged war. So I think there is a danger that this does drag on. And, of course, the most positive scenario would be a speedy Ukrainian victory, a return, as Denis said, to the status quo before the 24th of February 2022 would be, that's the definition of a Ukrainian victory in this war. And that's what I hope happens. But whether that's the most likely scenario, I think it's really hard to say. Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true, but no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny, and that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org.
So I'm going to go to everybody on this question. Why did Russia invade Ukraine?
So I think this has always been about fear that democracy in Ukraine might spread to Russia. That's what I think it's about. A lot of people in the West say, oh, it was all because of NATO expansion. And I do think NATO expansion was a mistake. I do think that after the end of the Cold War, we had an opportunity to demilitarize Europe and to create a pan-European security system that Ukraine was a part of. But I think it doesn't explain this madness. And the madness is the real fear those guys in power have that democracy in Ukraine will threaten them. And of course, they believe all that crazy rhetoric about Novorossiya and the ancient lands of Russia and spheres of influence. And I guess 2 years of the pandemic, 2 years of COVID, has made them even more inward looking and crazy. I honestly think that Russia would actually invade Ukraine because I was quite sure there would be a Ukrainian resistance. And I thought, if I was quite sure, why didn't Putin realize that? And I think you can only explain that in terms of the sort of isolation of that regime. So my answer is, it's the nature of the system, this horrible, oligarchic, criminalized, kleptocratic, toxic, masculine regime. That's, those sorts of regimes do become, in the end, revisionist, revanchist, whatever you want to call them.
I mean, Dennis, do you feel like it was the threat posed by Ukrainian democracy? Does that ring true?
I would generalize that, like, Putin's regime, which is authoritarian regime, was clear in suppressing any kind of democratic uprisings in the post-Soviet space. So this was the case with the protests in Belarus. This was the case with this January uprising in Kazakhstan. In the case of Armenia, they just in some other way humiliated it, providing no assistance during the war with Azerbaijan. So it's clear that Putin's regime and in general this ruling class of Russia, that is this nexus of what Mary described, these criminal oligarchs, Siloviki, the people from the security services and so on, and in general this bureaucrat bourgeoisie. So altogether, this nexus, it's going to preserve its grab on power by maintaining a similar regime throughout, like the former outskirts of the Soviet Union. Of course, it made it so vehement in rejecting any kind of democratic transitions. But it was partially also in this revival of some kind of grand Russian chauvinism and revanchism, that we need to take back the old Russian Empire. And in these warmongering speeches that led to proclamation of this war by Putin, he was directly attacking the revolutions, the 1917 revolutions, Bolsheviks and Lenin personally, for the mere existence of Ukraine as a separate entity, as a separate republic. So it's clear that he is denying any kind of subjectivity or agency on the side of Ukraine as people, as a separate state, as a republic. And his intentions were to subjugate in a way or another, first with the annexation of Crimea, then by steering the war in the east of Ukraine, in the Donbas, and now with a full-scale invasion. However, it also seems that this can be actually the beginning of the end of this rule. And obviously, we will feel secure, not just as people in Ukraine, but I think that people in Russia as well, only with the end of the current right-wing conservative authoritarian oligarchic regime in the Kremlin.
So look, a two-pronged question. A, do you agree that this was written in the stars, that there was, that there, if Putin never accepted the agency autonomy of Ukraine, then he would always have invaded at some point? And B, do you think that has been given, that has been precipitated in the immediate term by the kind of pressure from the latest IPCC report condemning fossil fuel extraction? And, you know, his feeling kind of marginalized, that there being no place for kind of Russian supremacy on an energy basis in a kind of modern world, and therefore that precipitating the act.
Yeah, and I think that there's a distinction or a discussion amongst leftists that's worth thinking about. So on the one hand, you know, some people stress material interests, and you can fit the ecological oil question well into that paradigm of material interests. So this would argue that basically, you know, the kind, as Mary said, the kind of capitalism that has developed in Russia since the 1990s was very prone to this kind of centralization of economic and political power. And oil was very, and gas were very helpful to this system, because they concentrated it all together, and the elite then just extracted rents from those commodities, and therefore were able to detach themselves to some degree from the rest of society. So the whole question of needing to, say, raise taxes in order to fund certain social services in order to win elections became, it entered into decline in that situation. And so I think that material factors have a huge role to play here. But of course, those kinds of material factors have to then be thought about, discussed, and turned into ideological considerations. Mm-hmm. So it's not counterposed to stressing nationalism and colonial nationalism, because I think in a way you can read Putin and Putinism as a kind of process of radicalization over time. And so Putin began to believe in the ideologies that he initially just provided patronage for in Russian society. And I think once you get in, when he was in power for a very long time, you know, and I know everyone talks about Russia as an oligarchy, but in some ways it's an autocracy. And I think that's a challenge that the sanctions have. It's not clear to me how much a direct political power and pressure the economic elite can really have on Putin. In some ways, it's the rule of a single leader. And that single leader became himself very isolated from society. And I think part of the explanation for the Ukraine war is this obsession with his legacy. So obsession with leaving his mark, the leader who, in a way, recreated, as Dennis said, the Russian Empire and Russian imperialism, again, with this expansionary war. And of course, that has failed. And that's a very dangerous kind of situation for the whole world to be in, with the failure of that vision, hopefully.
Mary, I can see you want to come in then.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Luke. And I think these kinds of regimes are very much based on rentier income. And we see that in many of the areas that have conflicts, that where you can create an oligarchic regime. My colleague Alex de Waal calls it the political marketplace, where politicians compete in different ways for access to revenue, and where they don't have to care about ordinary people because they have enough money, they're only interested in their own sources of income. I think Luke is, and I think it's important to say that, because you get away from this typical East-West thinking. I mean, there are elements of this in Trump and even in Brexit, since government has become so dependent on city finance. And of course, you see it in an extreme way in Assad's Syria or in places like Sudan and South Sudan. So I think that's one reason why it's important to think about this material basis. But the other thing I would say is that, yes, it's true that Putin's an oligarch, and you never actually know in terms of individual motivation whether people want to win power because they care about ethnic nationalism and they want to expand Russia, but they require an oligarchic system to get into power, or whether they want to get into power to make money and they frame it as being about ethnic nationalism. It can be both. It's these oligarchic systems are systems. And I think the thing about Putin's regime, which is kind of alarming, is that he has deliberate, which is also what Assad did, he's deliberately implicated the other oligarchs in his crimes, which makes it terribly difficult to break. That's how he's established his autocratic power. And indeed, you know, a Ukrainian colleague was saying to me that one of the reasons for the bombing of civilians or deliberate looting and deliberate rape is to implicate all these guys who are in the operation in his crimes.
Right, so that
they will remain loyal, because without him, they can think of nothing but The Hague, criminal justice, and all the rest of it.
To go on to the response in the West, in terms of governments, is the what should the West be doing now? And what in its actions already should it have worked on?
It's complicated to speak about some kind of collective West as some monolith entity.
Clearly, military aid and assistance to Ukraine is extremely important. And I think the UK government is right to be providing lots of what it calls defensive military aid, so things like anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft weapons. It's possible that that military aid might be able to go further. I think that to provide maybe some recycled Soviet-era fighter planes has been talked about. I think that would be worthwhile doing if it was possible. I know Ukrainians are really desperately keen on this, because we have been talking to Ukrainians a lot over the last few weeks, and I think it is happening. I don't think it's necessarily a complete answer to the conflict ultimately, because that's going to be down to the ability of Ukraine to really organize and run a functioning war economy. And I guess that's what I would emphasize. And crucially, as someone who's obviously not sympathetic to the current UK government, to say the least, I think this is where the UK should be doing much, much, much more. So Ukraine is still paying interest payments on a completely unsustainable economic debt. And people talk about a Marshall Plan for Ukraine. Now, that's, I think, I understand why that's being emphasized, but it's mistaken. A Marshall Plan, the analogy is about post-war reconstruction. What Ukraine needs now is massive economic investment and capital to grow its economy and to grow a war economy. And that means in the western part of the country, taking as many efforts as Ukraine can with international assistance to build and sustain armament industries. It means building and sustaining a social infrastructure, keeping its agriculture going. And there are things like, you know, we had a discussion with Ukrainian economists last week, and they made the really good point that insurance is critical in a war economy, because, of course, the market can't provide insurance. How can you insure a house that might be bombed tomorrow? It simply can't happen. So how do you insure farmers to be able to invest in their land over the next year? The government has to provide that.
I totally agree with everything that Luke has said. But actually, I think the scenario of Ukrainian victory is not very likely. And the only way I can see that this war will end is if there's a sufficient opposition inside Russia. And that would also include the soldiers refusing to fight. And there's quite a long history in Russia of Soviet. After all, that's what happened in 1917. It's what happened in the first Chechen War. So I think what the West needs to do is to think a lot more about what it needs to do to support a Russian opposition. I think it needs to offer asylum to any Russian soldiers who want to give up fighting. And I think the Ukrainians should do that too. I think on the sanctions, I mean, I think it was great that we imposed these massive sanctions to show Russia how much we disapproved. But some of the sanctions are quite problematic. Some of them affect the very people who would be the basis of an anti-war movement, people who have Visa and MasterCards and who travel to the West. And the danger of those kinds of sanctions is that those people, combined with Putin's repressive measures, will leave, leaving behind the old traditional working class who are much more inclined to believe the Putin lies. So I think we need, you know, I would like, it's too late not to have those sanctions. We can't lift them, but maybe we could think about some kind of conditional lifting in relation, say, to humanitarian corridors or other things agreed in the talks, or lifting of repressive measures. But I just think we need a much cleverer strategy about how to make it possible for there to be a Russian opposition.
I think that Luke, he pointed out many of the needed things. So actually, it's we now speak about what is to be done on several levels and what is to be done urgently. So obviously, Ukraine needs maximum assistance, both in the ways to support its citizens, including those who had to become refugees. It's not just about the Ukrainian citizens, but all the people, regardless of their origin and their citizenship, who had to flee Ukraine. So, and this is a good lesson for the West, how to treat refugees and people who are fleeing from war and misery, the people from Afghanistan, Somalia, Sudan, and so on. They also had this human dignity to be respected. And that this should be a template for all further crises. We also need to think about more structural things in order to keep Ukrainian economy running now. And also in order to recover, to rebuild the country after the war, we need like a completely different approach to the social and economic policies. So we need this cancellation of Ukraine's debt. And again, this can be a good example for all those people, especially in the global south, who are struggling to get out of this vicious circle of debt and austerity policies. We need these massive investments to build a new infrastructure and to rebuild the infrastructure after the war. And it also means to connect with the previous question that was about this, the question of fossil fuels. Again, what lesson had to be learned about the fossil fuel empires, right? Putin's Russia or the Saudi Arabia with its equally criminal war in Yemen? Well, we were expecting more about talk about just transition, about at least Green New Deal and hopefully a more radical eco-socialist vision of the future of the world.
We have to end fossil fuels, not just because of climate change, but because they create rich dictators.
Yeah.
So it spoke about climate change and democracy.
Mary, I want to just touch on a huge question from the audience, which is what are the implications if China weighs in on Putin's side, and how likely do you think that is?
I think Ruth would be much better at answering that question than me, but I think it would be very, very worrying, and it's a huge relief that the Chinese abstained in the United Nations General Assembly resolution.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that Ukraine will offer a lesson to China in relation to Taiwan.
I also hope that Ukraine offers a lesson to China in terms of the hidden in plain sight goal of the Xi Jinping regime to retake Taiwan peacefully if they can, forcefully if they must. And that will be a diabolical imperialist invasion of a sovereign state, not formally, but effectively a sovereign state, and would be a clearly imperialist action. I think Ukraine, as we discussed earlier, has achieved extraordinary things over the last month in terms of its self-defense, and I'm sure it will continue for the simple reason that Putin doesn't have the support that he thinks he has inside the country. And any invasion of Taiwan would be exactly the same story, but with the proviso that Taiwan are much better armed and with American weapons. And the strategic geography of Taiwan is very different. So there are only 11 beaches where the Chinese could land troops. So they're actually very easy to defend militarily, relatively speaking. So the cost to Chinese lives of a Taiwanese invasion would be absolutely huge. And so I think this whole geopolitical scenario is not really one that China would have chosen. I think the Chinese state foreign policy establishment were ambivalent on a Russian invasion of a Ukraine. When it happened, they wanted Putin to have as quick as possible victory because they are fundamental allies. They've made that clear around the Winter Olympics and in the run-in to it too, that it's an unbreakable bond and between the two nations, because they share a hostility to democracy and liberalism. And they think that the age of American hegemony, I mean, they might be right about this, by the way, is over, and that a new age of a multipolar order in which they can assert their interests much more ruthlessly without having any of the niceties of a rule of law system is here to stay. But I think it's just so disruptive to China, so disruptive to its economic relations to the Western world, that this isn't a crisis that they choose. And so that does leave the potential silver lining that China could apply some pressure on Putin to go to the peace table. And it will be important for states that still have diplomatic avenues towards Moscow to really push that agenda. And you've seen over the last week, obviously, Turkey that hasn't introduced sanctions on Russia, but did vote against Russia at the UN General Assembly. They're playing this kind of mediation role. And you know, it's up to the Ukrainians what a peace settlement that's acceptable to them. It's not for any international observers or supporters to say what an acceptable peace agreement looks like. That has to be a Ukrainian consideration. But obviously, we do all need to hope that this war is brought to an end as soon as possible on terms that are acceptable to Ukraine.
We have to draw this to a close with that. I really want to thank the panel, especially Dennis, calling from unimaginable circumstances.
Absolutely.
And to offer all our solidarity. It's a fascinating discussion, but also a very painful one. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. It's really good to meet you. And Ukraine is in all of our hearts and minds right now, and wishing Ukrainians a speedy victory.
That concludes this episode of the Another Europe podcast. There's no extra time on this occasion, as this was a special live audience event. Usually members of Another Europe get access to an extended version of the podcast as a benefit of membership. You can still join our people-powered movement to support and take part in our campaigning efforts. We've been doing lots of solidarity work with Ukraine. To find out more and get involved, go to anothereurope.org, where you can also find details of future podcast events. See you next time.